funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. It is a rare cause that can unite health nuts, homemakers, religious leaders, and sex radicals. But in fact, these strange bedfellows did come together in surprising ways during the 20th century in support of the nudist movement, which drew support from people who hoped walking around unclothed might offer everything from unencumbered exercise and wholesome family activities to a culture freed from the constraints of traditional mores about sexuality. As my guest will tell us, the nudist movement's many promises forced its champions to grapple with still unanswered questions about the differences between erotic and platonic nudity, between morally acceptable and deviant sexuality, and innocent and prurient imagery. Historian Brian Hoffman explores this complex subject in his new book, Naked, A Cultural History of American Nudism. Brian, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
Some people might assume that in order to, you know, give several years of your life to studying this, you would have to be like some nudity advocate. What, in fact, drew you to this subject?
Well, I come at it through as a historian. So I was attracted to this topic because it was a great source. It allowed me to see how American attitudes towards nakedness were changing over a very long period of time. Despite the fact that we all have naked bodies, they're relatively hidden away from history, behind closed doors or underneath our clothes. So the nudist movement and the debates and the legal battles that surrounded it over the course of the 20th century allowed me to gauge the way American attitudes about the body were changing. I was particularly fascinated about why Americans link shame to the naked body so strongly, in contrast to places in Europe or other places in the world. And I think this fascination really came out of the fact that I had a relatively unusual upbringing as a child. My parents were definitely part of the counterculture. They would identify themselves as hippies, and on weekends or in block parties, they were definitely clothing optional moments, right? So there was a great deal of awkward, unusual photos in my photo album, something that you don't show the girlfriend on the first date, definitely. And this was part of our family culture, is how we grew up, me and my sister and my parents and the whole neighborhood, really. And then as I grew older, it was pretty clear to me that other families didn't have the same experience I did. And so I wanted to continue to explore, why did some families see the body as shameful or something to hide away, or that it wasn't appropriate to be seen, whereas my family seemed to have absolutely no problem with it whatsoever. So this was a kind of lingering question from my childhood, but I'm not necessarily a nudist advocate. I am a historian. I think it's actually important that we analyze nudism from outside the movement. There's a great deal of books, hagiographies about nudism for over the course of the century, people writing on the behalf of nudism. I thought it was interesting to use the movements as a lens to see a wider American kind of social and cultural beliefs about nakedness and how we kind of make the naked body on an everyday basis.
A lot of people might be surprised to learn that nudism as we know it is not an American invention, but a German import.
Yeah, it definitely has German origins, going back to the late 19th century even, which predates the American movement by a few decades. It was a reaction to the rapid industrialization and urbanization of German society. There was groups, a big reform impulse, not just with nakedness and nudism, what would become Nachtkultur, but a wider desire to return to this pre-industrial past, to have land reform and vegetarianism and oppose, you know, too much alcohol drinking. And so nudism kind of grew out of this, especially in the rural areas of Germany. After World War I, nudism becomes a way of regenerating the Volk, the nationhood, you know, the national pride. And so it's a way of strengthening the body, especially within working class groups, Marxist-oriented groups that are catering to urban audiences and populations. And it grows quite popular to the point that Americans who had been participating in the First World War started to stumble across these groups and study them and participate in them. and then write books on them. And that's really how it transports itself to the United States as a popular genre of nudist writing that's able to survive even the Great Depression. Of course, they're illustrated, so people have a great deal of interest in them, and they do well. They go through multiple editions.
There was nothing particularly exhibitionistic about Nacht culture. It was a lot about like working out in the buff. What were thought to be the mental and physical benefits of exercising with no clothes on?
Sure. Nacht culture in particular, it's a little bit more extreme than the American variant, was very much about exercise and living life to the bare minimum. They're almost all vegetarian, very, very health oriented. They believe that exposing the body to the sun and the air and water kind of would allow them to absorb like vitamin D, restore muscles, create bone growth, create a strong body that's able to stand up to the elements. And it was definitely, you know, they would wake up at ungodly hours, like 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, to exercise in extreme conditions. I mean, right now we're at the beginning of summer, and, you know, when it's humid, it makes sense to take off your clothes.
Right.
But in many instances here in Germany, you would have very cold weather, even snow, and they would brave those conditions to exercise, you know, sans clothing in the name of health to strengthen and guard the body against the elements. It was also a way of kind of removing shame from the body. It was central that women and men work out together. And that way it removes that stigma of eroticism, of illicitness that they believed was being kind of heightened through the fact that it was hidden, that it created a curiosity, an unhealthy curiosity that could only be treated by letting everything be seen. And that part of nudism definitely survives across the Atlantic and takes root in the United States. That's a defining aspect of it. Otherwise, it's kind of like just going to the YMCA or a health club. But it was central that men and women kind of do this together in a state of complete nudity.
Having grown up, and I don't mean to make this about you, but having grown up in a family where it wasn't unusual for people to see one another without clothes on, do you think that's true? Like, did you manage to get through that time when we all act like giggling seventh graders at the thought of someone, you know, walking around with no clothes on? Does it sort of take away whatever is, embarrassing to people about nudity?
You know, I don't know. I've talked with friends that have had similar experiences, and myself, and there's other historians who, now that we're coming of age, the children of the counterculture, that have this kind of like opposite reaction, that we're even more uptight about it, you know, is because, you know, it was cool for our parents, but if it's cool for your parents, then it's probably not so much for you, you know,
right.
So they've kind of taken that away from you. A personal anecdote, my wife happens to be Korean, and Koreans, a big part of Korean culture is to go to public spas. And when we were first married, my in-laws invited my whole family over to Korea to experience like what the country is like. And one of the first things they did was invite us all to the public spa. And this made me quite uncomfortable. Like, I didn't want to go take a shower with my father-in-law and my brother-in-law. I just got married. You know, it was weird. But boy, were my parents, absolutely no problem. Like, let's go. And, you know, they never had a better time in their life. They bonded over it. It was a great experience. But for me, it was like, geez, what's going on here? You know? And so, maybe it's just me, but I think a lot of, we're exposed to all these things early on, and I'm not, a prude or anything, and I'm certainly not gone like religious, or I don't see the body as shameful, but I do see it in a very complex way that people have a variety of different reactions to it, not just erotic, but it's also therapeutic. There's an aesthetic dimension to it. There's all sorts of ways of seeing the naked body. That maybe a lot of Americans just see it through like the lens of pornography. And I think that's what makes America a little bit different, is that we're very limited in how we see the naked body. And because it's so commercialized in America, and I think that's a contrast to places like Korea or Europe as well, where you can see the naked body in a lot of different venues.
So many people are aware of like the 1960s and 70s as this counterculture era, and you think about the sexual revolution. But of course, a lot changed in the 1920s. Even the fact that, you know, women went from wearing, you know, skirts to the floor to skirts at the knee was a big deal. And that went along with a lot of really different ideas about human sexuality and about premarital sex. Did that pave the way for something like nudism to take hold in the 30s?
Sure, absolutely. The changing mores around sexuality, especially in the 20s, was critical to the opening up and the flourishing of nudism at that moment. Like in 1929, there's a lot of things changing. Movies are now becoming much more titillating, you know, no pun intended. You're seeing a dating culture emerging around public schools that are now like compulsory. You have the car, which is allowing young people greater access to privacy. And so there's a lot more experimentation with sexuality, as long as it's done in a heteronormative way. If it's between a white man and a white woman, and it's ultimately going to pay off with a family in the end, people are becoming much more tolerant of that vein of sexuality. There's the days of the moral absolutism where the leg of the, you know, coffee table is eroticized and we must cover it up. Those days are fading away pretty quickly. Activists like Margaret Sanger are calling for greater access to birth control. There's several court cases where the book Ulysses that are dealing with very scandalous material are now getting, you know, free access to the free public space. There's a lot changing at this moment, and the nudists really fit into that. Without those changes, it would have been very hard for them to take hold. And they position themselves within those changes as being very heterosexual, mom and pop, that this is ultimately about family and respectability. And it's within that kind of sexual mores that nudism really establishes itself in the United States in the 1920s and 30s.
What was a family-centric nudist resort like?
It changes over time. In the 1930s, they're trying to establish themselves, and it really is quite rustic. It's a reaction to the fact that nudism received a hostile reception in the cities, where it was linked with like burlesque and pornography and kind of the underbelly of New York or Chicago. And so they go out into the countryside and establish these havens for nudism. And they really set it up as like kind of a Garden in Eden experience, that this is a place free of sin. It's about skinny dipping. It's about investing yourself in nature and the health qualities that come from nature. They wouldn't necessarily be doing the calisthenics and routines that the Germans would be doing. They would be sunbathing or hiking or swimming. And it was a much more relaxed setting. It was a way of escaping the ills of modern society. By the 1950s, however, the nudist resort changes, and it becomes much more plush. It becomes about tourism, and it's a destination. It has swimming pools and water skiing and all sorts of dining. It's a very different kind of setup. And I'm assuming from the music we can talk about that when we come back.
We will in just a moment. My guest is historian and author Brian Hoffman. His new book is called Naked, A Cultural History of American Nudism. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, a customizable evening master's degree for working professionals. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with historian Brian Hoffman. His new book is called Naked, A Cultural History of American Nudism. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Brian, you were saying that by the 1950s, nudist resorts had become a lot more luxurious. I'm guessing it was probably a good thing that all those rustic picnic tables got sanded down. But it did sort of change the experience of family groups in particular who wanted to go there and hang out.
Yeah. So in the 1950s, you know, tourism in the United States is really taking off, especially around the car. You know, it's after the war, the Depression's behind us. And people are really starting to go out and explore the nation in their cars, in, you know, going to Disneyland or a national park. And others go off the beaten path and visit these clubs, is really the accurate word for them these in the 1950s. And they're set up around the family. There's a place for the kids to hang out, and there's pools. And they're much more constructed than they were in the past, in the 30s and 40s. And it really takes off as a kind of, you know, part of the domestic environment of 1950s society, which is really ironic because we associate nudism today with like the counterculture and beating the man. But in many ways, it was a fit into 1950s conservative, kind of heteronormative culture. And it was really a family affair. So it was built around, you know, the man bringing his wife and child. A single man, however, would not be as welcome into the nudist confines, that they would either be banned entirely or charge higher rates or required to bring a woman, that they would turn them away. And that was in order to create this kind of domestic environment that fit into 1950s kind of society.
Even in the 1950s, there were people worried that particularly unattached adult men would either be interested in leering at the women or the men, or of greater concern to everyone was them leering at children. People were thinking about this.
Yeah, yes and no. So the single man is a threat for a lot of reasons. I mean, you don't know why he's there exactly. He could be there because he's a health enthusiast and he's a nudist and he's sincere. But he could also be there to check out other women. In fact, your wife or your daughter. He could also be there to check out other men. These were all anxieties of nudism. And they were also very worried about the movement being redefined as being male dominated, that it would no longer be about family, but it would be more something more akin to the gay bathhouse that were around and quite prominent in San Francisco or New York, that it would be redefined as deviant rather than familial and domestic. So there was a lot of reasons to exclude the single man from these nudist camps. And around children, however, there were incidents in the past where men would get into trouble, divorced men, single men. Even Eiley Boone had some rumors around him. He was one of the founders of the nudist movement. But this was all kind of swept under the rug pretty easily because in 1950 society, it wasn't something that was exposed. Like it wasn't in like our world, this is a major line that we don't cross. But in 1950 society, it wasn't necessarily polite or appropriate to be discussing these things or looking at these things or thinking about the relationship between children and adults, even in a naked state, in that kind of way. And so you would have a lot of judges looking at pictures of young naked girls or even from police who raided camps saying, like, there's nothing wrong with that, that actually the children being there are a sign of innocence. And they didn't think of the threat of intergenerational sexuality really until the counterculture. You would have a great movement by feminists to kind of expose that there are things going on at nudist camps. And today this is actually still a very contentious and controversial aspect of nudist camps, especially as they've evolved in the 21st century.
These mid-century camps also went to great lengths to stay segregated, or I should say to exclude people of color. Is that still the case?
I don't think that's the case anymore. I think that fell firmly with the counterculture. They are, you know, quite accepting of all people from different walks of life. In the 1950s, though, it was definitely a segregated environment. The body of the African-American man in particular was a threat to nudist respectability. There weren't a whole lot of African-Americans trying to join nudist camps in the 1950s, although it did happen, and there are very interesting sources around it. And it did cause quite a stir and controversy in a camp in San Diego. However, nudists were very uncomfortable with how people would see the movements more than anything else, I think, that allowing African-Americans into camps would kind of make them seem deviant or hypersexual or hypereroticized because of the type of connotations that the African-American body had in mid-1950s society.
Were there people, Brian, who thought, let's set up a nudist camp, and in addition to normalizing the naked body, let's normalize sexual relations between consenting adults who may or may not be in a permanent relationship?
In mid-century society, no. You know, that was very much frowned upon. The hanky-panky was not allowed in nudist resorts. In fact, they strictly guarded against it. It's going on, like it's happening, like
especially happens at Club Med, right?
Right. You know, tourist spaces like Club Med especially relax the mores around sexuality. So things are happening there. There is whispers and rumors, and there's definitely stuff going on. And when they start doing all the studies in the late 1960s of what life is like in nudist camps, they unearth a lot of this hanky-panky and swinging and stuff that had been going on in nudism. But in terms of the surface, the way they advertise themselves in magazines and talk about nudism, they're really trying to divorce the naked body from sexuality. And, you know, their point is that there's more to nakedness than sex. And it's true, right? So the naked body has all these other purposes. It's healthy. It's therapeutic. It's a kind of aesthetic, right, and an experience. But at the same time, like, I think this is where nudism starts being a little bit disingenuous, is that it's hard to completely de-eroticize the naked body, that it is part of a reproductive process. There is an eroticism to it. And there is that kind of feeling that, you know, people would have. But erections were very much frowned upon in 1950s, 1940s nudism. And this is actually what the counterculture would start to critique the old generation of nudists for, is that they were being a bit insincere with suppressing sexuality. So you would have a, you know, pretty stringent critique from a young generation that sees nudity and public nudity as a way of advocating for the politics of sexual liberation. And they are firmly rejected by these older, more established camps. And they'll end up splintering off and kind of create their own vein of nudism, which we know today as naturism, that it creates almost a different movement. So a good example of this in Texas that people might be familiar with is there's the Ponderosa Nudist Club, which I think is by Dallas. It's very family-oriented. It still has different price rates for families versus single men. They really try to divorce sex from the experience of going nude at their camp. And then there's Hippie Hollow, right?
Which in Austin,
basically
right.
in near Austin, where anything goes. And that's a product of the counterculture, right? That's where it really started to explode. And it's become kind of a national, you know, target for nude sunbathing. And anyone's allowed to go there, and anything kind of happens there. And so it is kind of a moment or a lightning rod for controversy around naked activities and nudism.
So you mentioned advertising a while ago. And of course, it shouldn't surprise people that if you start a business, be it a dry cleaners or a nudist resort, you're going to want people to come. Tell us a little bit how these camps and resorts promoted themselves to the public and how they got the word out that they were around.
Sure. So the main way the movement first begins through these books that are kind of introducing the philosophy and idea of going naked, and they're showing what German nudist camps look like. Very quickly from there, you see this man named Reverie Illy Boone established a magazine called The Nudist. It's a large print magazine, glossy pages, wonderful, beautiful pictures, and tons of articles. And this is how people learned about nudism in the United States. It would go through the mails, or it would be featured on certain newsstands. And it featured information about camps. It would profile certain groups. It would discuss the philosophy of nudism. It would have personal stories from people about their first experience going naked. And this is how people learned about nudism. It's also how people access a form of pornography that really wasn't available in many other places. So it featured both men and women in all different states of dress. It was self-censored initially in the 30s and 40s. They kind of airbrushed over the genitalia, which created some really bizarre images. But it was something that they would, you know, that people didn't see anywhere else. And there would be about 80,000 issues, you know, per month or so. And so this was a fairly popular way of looking at the naked body. And it kind of allowed nudists also to talk to themselves about what's going on. What were the legal battles? What were the struggles going on? How could they help each other? And this magazine is, you know, central to the establishment of American nudism. And it's also one of the places where you have a lot of the legal battles occurring. And eventually they're able to come out victorious in the late 1950s and are able to display full frontal nudity. And this raises all sorts of questions about, you know, where's the line between the illicit and the therapeutic, or the erotic and the respectable? It depends on sometimes who's looking at the pictures. You know, and this is what gave the court such a difficult time ruling on these magazines.
What's the relationship between those magazines promoting a lifestyle, which we should be clear always sold more copies than the places they promoted had tourists? The relationship between those publications and then what would, you know, become magazines that were really maybe not hardcore pornography, but they existed specifically to display naked images, particularly of women.
Sure. So, I mean, there's an evolution of this. Early on, it's very family oriented. You know, the pictures are generally of groups of people, distant. It's during World War II that the magazine really changes, that the camps are really struggling to stay afloat. People can't travel the same way they were able to because of rationing. And they start leaning on this magazine as a revenue source. And the people they're selling it to are soldiers who are serving abroad. And they get all these letters from soldiers saying how much they enjoy this magazine in their time, you know, when they're so lonely, right? And the covers then become very similar to pinups. They look like the Marilyn Monroe and the Betty Page, and they're very erotic. And you can see a dramatic change in the covers of the magazine. The insides, for the most part, stay the same, although you start to see a lot more kind of muscle men images that are appealing to a homosexual audience in the United States that's using these magazines as well. The success that they get during the Second World War by selling this as a type of pornography allows them to contest the legal restrictions on these magazines. It gives them the ability to pursue the legal battles that were previously too expensive. And ultimately, by the late 50s, they're able to remove all restrictions on what they can display by walking this thin line of, you know, is it for nudism or is it for pornography? It's never quite clear. It's a gray area. And they exploit that gray area in the courts. It's very difficult for the courts to make a consistent ruling. And ultimately, by undoing the censorship around nudist magazines, they create a whole new genre of pornography, of more hardcore pornography that we would recognize today, where full frontal nudity of both men and women is on full display. And it's ironic because the nudist, which becomes Sunshine in Health, ends up going bankrupt in 1963, only a couple years after it removes censorship from its pages. Because it can no longer compete in what is now a very crowded market of nudie magazines. And so it was one of those really interesting ironies that it was a victim of its own success.
It's also interesting to think, Brian, about the early iterations of these magazines featuring images of both women and men, and the cover those must have provided for gay men who were interested in pornography, but particularly if they were in the service, they could easily walk around with a magazine that had a picture of a woman on the cover and might feature images of naked men within its pages.
Absolutely. It has a lot to do with like who's looking at the magazine and what they want to look at. Since both types of bodies are there, by having those naked women in there, it was a perfect cover for gay men. And they used it. You can tell by not only the pictures that the editors were choosing to include, but there would be advertisements for masseuses in certain parts of Los Angeles or San Francisco, where they're using certain language to appeal to gay men. There would also be advertisements of people looking for other nudists, men looking for other nudists, and it would read much more like a dating ad. So the gay community that was beginning to flourish after the Second World War in places like Los Angeles and San Francisco or New York was definitely looking to Sunshine Health as a way of kind of building and connecting with other gay men and women. Early homophile organizations would also be, would write profiles about their experiences trying to join nudist camps, and that they would have trouble because they wouldn't have female partners. And so they would be encouraging women to come so they could enjoy nudism, which they thought was the perfect atmosphere for gay men to kind of hang out. I think it was a way of liberating themselves from the gay spa, which is kind of this dark, secretive, kind of almost persecuted place where police were constantly raiding, that the nudist camp was a much better cover as well.
Historian Brian Hoffman is my guest. We're talking about his book, Naked, A Cultural History of American Nudism. You can join us in the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, specializing in communications or organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with historian Brian Hoffman about his new book, Naked, A Cultural History of American Nudism. Brian, just when you think this story is as complex as it's going to get, you turn the page and learn that some of the champions of nudism in the mid-20th century were religious leaders.
Yeah, it's one of the really interesting parts of this that several of them, the Reverend Illy Boone, the Reverend Henry Huntington, were very religious and devout, and they saw nudism as a way of kind of building on the story of Garden of Eden. So returning to this moment before the fall, and that the body doesn't have to have shame, and recreating this kind of scenic Garden of Eden in these camps. And they saw it as a religious experience, as a way of returning to the true values of the Bible, that before the body was kind of clothed in sin, that they were going to purify it by removing these illicit garments, right, that have becoming kind of hypersexualizing the body, especially in the 20s and 30s. So you did have this kind of religious vein going through nudism. And it coexists alongside a kind of bohemian, kind of Greenwich Village kind of ethos running through it as well. So it is weird to see this movement that has both of these kind of influences on it, both religious and faith, and at the same time a kind of progressive, bohemian kind of strain going through it as well.
And there was a similar tension in the 60s and 70s as we've discussed, the counterculture embraced nudism. On the other hand, you know, these second wave feminists were finding pornography really offensive, and people could find themselves in, you know, strangely different sides of the same argument.
Sure. Yeah. One of the things that I found fascinating while working on this was that when I told people I was doing nudism, they would also assume, as probably I did at the beginning, you know, these are hippies, this is the counterculture. But what we discovered, or what I discovered when working on this, is that it's not so simple, that the counterculture actually clashed pretty strongly with this older generation of nudists who had built the movement around respectability and domestic kind of values and family. And they end up clashing with the counterculture. This new counterculture introduces critiques of like sexuality and allowing a kind of more permissive attitude towards sex when you're not married, and group sex and swinging and all those kind of things. And they start to incorporate feminism. Because feminists, you know, what's going on right now is like the Free the Nipple campaign, right? Is that why should women be forced to cover their breasts while men aren't? You know, there's an inequality there. And so many feminists were attracted to public nudity, of expressing their womanhood through bearing all, right? And that they should be just as equal as men in going naked. And so the Naturist Society, in particular, incorporates feminist voices into the movement, and is quite a productive relationship early on in this late 60s, early 70s. But it leads also to feminists starting to critique how women are treated in the movement, that they are seen as kind of subservient, or that they're to please men, or that they're objects of men's gaze constantly. Or, and this is probably more significant, that they start to uncover that there's a lot of instances of pedophilia and child molestation going on here that people hadn't been articulating until the mid-70s or so, even going into the 80s. And so there's these really heated battles and controversies and arguments over, like, what pictures should magazines be displaying? You know, should they be including these really attractive women all the time? With kind of shaved pubic hair, which kind of signals pornography more than it does like the natural state of nakedness. Should they be picturing children, and how should they be picturing children? And then when there is instances of child molestation, how should the movement confront it? Should it just try to sweep it under the rug, or should it really be taking action against these people? And there are really heated battles that continue on today about these issues of nudism. And to me, the way I was analyzing it, this is more a reflection of our anxieties around nakedness and the naked body. It's no longer about promiscuity or homosexuality or even interracial sex. Those problems, those anxieties we have as a culture, have pretty much faded away. It's now about, you know, the child's body. And there's a whole lot of discomfort around the display of the naked child body that wasn't there, you know, even 20 years ago or 30 years ago. That the idea that the family can protect against, you know, that innocence, that purity of childhood, that's no longer there. That's been kind of faded away. And so nudism now has to confront that new understanding of nakedness, these new anxieties. And they're still struggling with it today.
What's really fascinating about this whole subject is that there's the question of, you know, what do people gain from hanging around in places that are, you know, quasi-public spaces that have been reserved for people to wear clothes or not as they choose. And then there's the question of the capturing of the images of people doing this. And there's no other way to describe it other than comic section in the book, where you write about the courts sort of talking about, like, there's basically an exception made for National Geographic to, you know, send issues across state lines. And there are, you know, particularly in the mid-century, lots of images of naked people.
Yes. So it's kind of interesting, like National Geographic especially is this kind of moment of hypocrisy, I think, that the nudists really zero in on. That, like, it's okay to show people of color, indigenous people, this kind of, like, you know, non-white other, that's fine. You know, people, like, that was a source of pornography. I think Richard Pryor, you know, joked that that was the best way to see African-American women's breasts or something. But now, so they use that kind of racial argument to kind of, you know, show the hypocrisy of banning their activities. They showing nudism and nudist life and the nudist way of life is a way of kind of like promoting the movement for nudists. And it's always something that they've kind of made a part of nudism in America, is that of showing it in magazines or in films or, you know, promoting it now on the web. You know, Twitter is all a huge nudist phenomenon. It's a way of promoting their movement through images because it's so different. It's a spectacle. But at the same time, like, you don't know how those images are always being received. And that's the tension, is that the question of, like, who's viewing them and, you know, exactly why are they being produced? Those are always the tensions behind nudist images.
We have an email here from Tierra who asks, do you think people are now more accepting of nudity due to TV shows like Naked and Afraid and right. Dating Naked?
Yeah, actually, I'm not sure it's those TV shows that are making it more accepting, as those TV shows are a reflection of how comfortable this new generation that's grown up in a digital age is with nudity. So I think there's a profound shift happening where we have cell phones. We don't have to worry about having those pictures developed. I mean, my parents didn't worry about having those pictures developed, but now we don't. You know, we have them on our phones, our computers, or whatever, the naked selfie. Celebrities do it. Everyday people do it. Kids get in trouble with it in high school. They invented Snapchat as a way of kind of avoiding the problem of what you do with these, you know, naked images. So this new digital generation has been much more like comfortable taking pictures of their bodies and displaying their bodies in a way that previous generations weren't, who had to depend on pornography or sexy films like Basic Instinct that were kind of seen as salacious. Now nakedness has become much more mundane. And it's really interesting. I've been fascinated by the censorship policies of companies like Facebook and Instagram that are really having a very narrow, limited definition of what nakedness is. You know, basically all nudity is illicit, except for breastfeeding. And even that was a controversy. And people are quite upset with that. Like, users are upset with it. Miley Cyrus is upset with it. Chelsea Handler has a problem with it. You know, this is user-generated content. Facebook is making a lot of money off of that content. And yet people are not allowed to do what they want with their images, and this generation's more comfortable with it. So I do think that Naked and Afraid and Dating Naked, which target younger audiences, is a reflection of how much more comfortable the kind of 20-somethings, the 30-somethings are with nudity in a digital age.
It's not like I'm a big fan, but the one interesting thing about Naked and Afraid that seems to separate it from every other depiction of nudity that I have seen in movies and, you know, cable TV shows and whatever, is that it's not about sex. Like, it's a survival show for people who haven't seen it. And basically, they drop you off in some harsh conditions, and you and a person have to figure out how to survive with no supplies, no clothes, no nothing. Every other time that you see nudity in a movie or on a TV show, it's almost invariably attached to some kind of sexual scene.
Right. And I think that's signaling that people, because the naked body is being displayed so much more like perfunctorily, that it's not like, it doesn't have to be eroticized anymore. It's not necessarily pornography. It's not always a spectacle, that there's this new space opening up for nakedness that, and like, yeah, Naked and Afraid is kind of ridiculous for how ridiculous it is. You know, right. Why would you want to do that? You know, but it's a signal that, you know, nakedness, certainly we expect to see something sexual or erotic, but there's more to it than that. And obviously the show's been able to sustain itself. And it signals that people are ready or are beginning to see the naked body in other ways. And it's why that discussion on Facebook is so interesting, is because it's not just about, like, you know, porn anymore. And Facebook, I think, is kind of slow to that, is that people are now seeing the naked body in a much more complicated way. that my book kind of signals to, that like the nudist movement, it shows that nakedness changes. Is not automatically shameful, it's not automatically erotic, that there's these other ways of seeing nudity in a natural setting, in a kind of therapeutic way, as an aesthetic, as, you know, art, as a statues. And, you know, Facebook has gone to great lengths to even remove those things.
I suppose there is still a nudist movement if people that I associate with are part of it. I don't know it. Would it surprise the founders of this, so the champions in the 1930s, that we are still so deeply ambivalent about being naked?
You know, I wonder. I think they would be okay with what's going on. I think that the counterculture and the sexual revolution kind of opened up things a lot. And there was a weird moment where in like 1968, 69, a lot of the old nudist leaders ended up passing away. And this kind of new movement opened up. And I think they might be uncomfortable with the kind of eroticism that's emerged. But nudism as a movement has also been able to sustain itself with these camps. Some of them have been surviving since the 1930s. I think they would be seeing it as a lot of progress has been made. Maybe it's not perfect, you know, except for certain places in San Francisco. There's not many people just walking around naked anywhere in America, and there's not a whole lot of beaches around. But I do think things have opened up and are going okay for the nudist movement. In fact, it's quite a tourist industry. It's like a $400 million a year industry in the United States, where you have cruises and really plush resorts that offer all sorts of facilities. And it's become like a niche in the tourist industry. So I think the old nudist leaders would be okay with it. You know, I think they would be all right with the state of nudism today. I think the thing that they would be discomforted by is the kind of anonymous relations that happen at camps now, that not everyone knows everyone. Not everyone knows everyone's name, that people come and go. It's like a hotel, much less than it is like a family kind of event or vacation.
Is the nudist movement here to stay? Will there always be a subset of the population that wants to do this and a larger subset that doesn't?
You know, I wonder if, you know, nakedness had become much more accepting in America, and it seems to be kind of heading that way, at least in a digital vein. Would you even need nudist camps? I don't know. Like, you know, obviously the United States is a big country and we haven't completely broken everything down and there's a lot of regional variations. But I think at least in, given the slightly hostile atmosphere to nakedness in many parts of the country, that nudist camps will be necessary. I think like especially in the counterculture, they wanted to kind of move away from the nudist camp, the nudist movement. And so they had like the World Guide to Nudist Recreation, which was, you know, just find a nice spot where you can go naked. And it was a much more natural kind of everyday thing instead of like this purposeful, like we need to go to this camp to, you know, go naked. So that would be a kind of nice way of kind of seeing the nudist movement grow, is to be just come an everyday kind of part of recreation.
Brian Hoffman's new book is called Naked, A Cultural History of American Nudism. Brian, it's been really interesting. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Knavy. Actually, today it was engineered by Alan Roberts. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones from Gus Contreras. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.